A little quick confession on my part. One of the lessons last Sunday that I entitled How to Live Among Wolves was actually kind of an addendum. I started out toward this sermon that I'm going to preach tonight, and the introduction turned into its own lesson. They do that sometimes. Whenever you're studying, and I had in my mind what I wanted the introduction and then how that would lead into this lesson, but that took a life of its own, and so I made two lessons out of this lesson that I intended. I would like for you to open your Bibles there where Joshua read to 1 Peter chapter 3, and we're going to use that as a text. And in conjunction with the lesson last week, we talked about the Lord sending his disciples out, and he said, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves, and so be wise and be harmless. And we talked about how to live as wise people and harmless people and what that means. And so that's the principles, and now a little bit more of some specifics about here we are in a world of wolves. And I don't know if that stuck with you or not, but I've had the conversation with someone, with different people several times this week about the fact that we are indeed living in a world of wolves. And sometimes we tend to forget that when the Lord has blessed us. But we don't need to let our guard down. We need to live wisely, and we need to live in a very focused manner. And now to talk about some specifics about what it is that here we are in the midst of a world of wolves, and what should we be doing specifically. Generally, at least in principle, we're to be like serpents and we're to be like doves. But now here are some specifics of what we should be doing. And if I had this cute little title, I'd give it to you. But four things that we need to be involved in constantly in this world of wolves that we live in. And the first one is in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. He says, whoever would love life and see good days must first of all keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. And so a Christian, first of all, controls his tongue. And it's quite often in these simple things that we get a little bogged down as far as not really applying these like we should. As a Christian, we need to be really involved and committed to watching what we say. There are times, each of us has certain tendencies in our speech. Sometimes we pop our mouth off when we ought to keep it closed. Sometimes we keep it closed when we ought to open it. Sometimes we say things that we think are really cute, and yet they hurt people. And we as Christians need to be really guarded about our speech. We need to think about what it is that we want to accomplish in our life. And with our speech, controlling our tongue is one of the marks of Christian maturity. In James chapter 3, you know, James chapter 3, verse 1 through 12, he talks about the importance of the tongue. He said, not many of you should presume to be teachers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he's a complete or mature man, able to keep his whole body in check. So he said, if you can control your tongue, you can control your whole body. It's the most difficult part of our lives and our bodies to control. And then he uses three illustrations. You're familiar with them. A bit, a rudder, and a little spark of fire. And he uses those to show how dangerous the tongue and how controlling and powerful the tongue is. He says that you put a bit in a horse's mouth and you can turn him any way you want to turn him. And then he says, even though the ship is a large thing and is blown by the wind, then the pilot can use a little small rudder and make that boat go where he wants to. And if it had been in the days of outboard motors, we would have had a prop. And I have to tell you, I've been on the water most of my life. I grew up on the river. But there is something that still amazes me, that a little prop about that big round can move a large boat as quickly as it can. It's just hard for me to get my mind around that, and it literally just screws its way through the water, very much like an airplane propeller screws its way through the atmosphere. And that's just hard for my mind to get around. And I look at these huge boats and look at the size of the prop, and you think, there's just not any way that that little small thing can move that boat at 45 or 50 or some of them over 100 miles an hour. But they can. And it's a powerful thing when it's put to good use, and it's a powerfully destructive thing when it's put to bad use. And that'll be the third thing that he says. He says, you see, you can set the world on fire with just a little small kindle of a match. Just a little bitty flame can start something. If any of you have ever had a fire that got out of control, you know how fearsome that is and how destructive it can be. And you can't, once it gets out of your control, you can't do anything about it. I mean, you can run around and try to stomp on it, and you can call all the help you want, but whenever it's a windy day like today, then a fire in the proper environment can outrun you. And it can actually outrun a vehicle whenever it gets in the proper, has the proper tinder to burn. And so the tongue, controlling a tongue, is a really crucial thing for us as Christians. And I'm afraid sometimes some of us take some pride in the sharpness of our tongue. And it can get to be a habit of life that's very difficult to break. And it starts out maybe that you consider yourself to be quick-witted, and you can always come back with a retort, and you can always have just the right cute little thing to say, and that can gain control of your life. There is a family that I know that they practice this constantly. There are two or three sons and a daughter and a mother and a father. And you don't want to get in a pun contest going back and forth with them. You can't win, because they can go on and on and on. And they deliberately practice it. When they get together as a family, they just see how long they can keep this going with these little cute little, and they get pretty cutting before it's over. And so he says in verse 6 through 10, or 3 through 6, he writes about the power of the tongue, and then verses 6 through 10, he emphasizes the danger that is inherent within the tongue, and then the need to control our tongue. And so we as Christians, one of the things is we're in a world of wolves, and it's a real temptation to grow some fangs. It's a real temptation to really develop your wit so that you can match wits with anybody verbally. And that creates a pride sometimes within us. But a Christian, he says, we need to carefully guard our speech, and it is, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from deceitful speech. Christian speech must be prepared. We need to think ahead about the kind of impression that we always want to leave on people. Colossians 4:6 and Ephesians 4:29 are two really good verses in conjunction with this. Colossians 4:6 says, let your speech always be with grace. And that word charis is kind or good. Let your speech always be kind speech, good speech, seasoned with salt. Or some versions will say pleasing, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. And then Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but let that which is good to the use of edifying, building others up, that it may minister grace to the hearers. Wouldn't it be a really nice thing to not ever say anything that you had to apologize for? Or that you needed to apologize for? Sometimes we say some things we need to apologize for that we don't. But wouldn't it be a neat thing to be able to go through the rest of your life and never say one thing that hurt anybody? Never say one thing that you needed to apologize about. And when we're in a family, we need to always be thinking about how we can build one another up, how we can encourage one another. And even sometimes the people that are the most difficult to talk with and to are the ones who need the most encouragement. And it really doesn't cost us anything to give somebody a word of encouragement, does it? And it does an incredible amount of good. And so let's never get tired as God's family with one another and with people that we encounter during the day. You can set the tone for somebody else's day. You can set your tone, the tone at the office. I'm not saying you can always control what everybody says. You can't. But you can certainly improve the environment in which you live by watching what you say and by noticing good things in other people and bringing those good things to light with your tongue. Maybe one of the things, I grew up in a house, somebody, who was it the other day, was talking about how many girls they had in their house. I forgot what it was. Somewhere it was the other day, talking about how much estrogen flowed in their house, you know. Well, anyway, I grew up in a world of, I didn't grow up, but as an adult, I've lived in a world of women for lots of years here. And there are some things I've learned about girls growing up that I didn't know. And I won't tell you everything I know because some of it's not real flattering, but the police chiefs, school teachers, and social workers are all reporting an alarming new trend in the United States. Girls are becoming more violent more often. The Justice Department statistics show that violent acts by teenage boys outstrips violent acts by teenage girls 4-1. Well, that's good news, right? But the bad part is that one generation ago, it was 10-1. And now it's 4-1. Former Baltimore School Police Chief Jansen Robinson commented that girls have gradually become as violent as boys. It's a nationwide phenomenon and is catching all of us off guard. I think that's kind of an interesting statement in view of what's been happening in the, quote, movement for women in our society in the last 30 years. Lauren Abramson, director of the Community Conferencing Center in Baltimore, agency that resolves disputes through mediation, has observed that gossip is often the root of aggression between girls. Gossip as a source of violence is understudied and little understood, but time and again, when we bring the parties together, get them to talk and dig into what started it all, it invariably comes back to something somebody heard somebody else said. Sabella Arts, A-R-T-Z, a researcher in bullying behavior and author of the book Sex, Power, and the Violent Schoolgirl, has found that since girls are more verbally skilled than boys, their aggression is often displayed through malicious gossip, threats, and intimidation. They'll create factions, groups, or small cliques, and they'll begin to character assassinate by creating rumors and gossip and building a consensus that a particular girl is in the wrong and deserves to be beaten and have retaliation. At the very least, this will show up as an exclusion or shunning. A girl will come to school and suddenly find herself excluded from a group that she once found herself belonging to, and she won't be told what it's about. Watching our tongue. Boy, the tongue is a powerful, powerful force, isn't it? And it can cause untold damage in people's lives and bring an incredible amount of pain. And so it's necessary. One of the things that we as Christians need to be really cautious about, watch ourselves about, is guard our tongue and our speech and make plans and make a deliberate effort and pray about and read scriptures about that a fitting word and how beautiful it is. It's like the King James Version says, apples of gold in frame of silver. It's a beautiful, fitting thing to say the right thing at just the right time, isn't it? To be able to feel like that you have contributed something really good to a difficult situation. Maybe you heard about the old man who had a serious hearing problem for a number of years, and his family kept trying to convince him to get a hearing aid. And finally he relented and went to the doctor and was fitted for hearing aids that allowed him to hear 100%. A month later he came back to the doctor, and the doctor said with a smile, "Your hearing is perfect. I suppose your family must really be pleased that you can hear again." The old man replied, "Oh, I haven't told my family yet." I just sit around and listen to their conversations. I've changed my will 3 times. Christian speech is to be guarded. And it's really a temptation to, particularly if you are capable of doing that, it's really a temptation to cut somebody back when they cut you, isn't it? To insult someone back. To wrong somebody with words whenever they do that to you. A Christian also, in this same context, secondly, turns away from evil. Shun evil and do good. And you know, man has known the difference between good and evil since the Garden of Eden, but if we're not careful, society living in the world of wolves will let that slip. And it's possible. It's possible for us to become so acclimated to coarseness in our society that we lose our sensitivity to what sin really is. We let it in our home and our TVs. We read about it. We deal with it and face it on the job every day. You can pervert that knowledge. Isaiah 5:20 says, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." And I think I can see some of that in our world, don't you? That we just have gotten things mixed up. One of the things that is a little distressing, and I guess it's because of where I come from, not locale-wise, but in light of the fact that computers and so forth have come into their own in my lifetime, and there was no such thing when I was born. And when I got to college, they were really, really primitive. But in reading news articles or things online, and then sometimes I'll go down and read the comments below them, and I should never do that because it always upsets me when I do, particularly if it's something about religion. Because people will say things about Christ and about religion and about Christians today that you would have never, ever heard 15 years ago. And they feel perfectly, not only free, but they seem to feel an obligation to be critical, hypercritical of Christians and the Bible and everything associated with God and His Word. And we're living in a society that has become increasingly evil or difficult to turn away from evil. The Christian abstains from evil. Abstains even. Paul will write to Thessalonian Christians in chapter 5, verse 22 of his first epistle and say, "Abstain even from the very appearance of evil." That takes some real dedication and desire in our life, doesn't it? Because there is so much of it around us. Not just with the tongue, but with our thoughts, with our deeds, with everything associated with our life. Romans 12:9 says, "Hate that which is evil." And you know, until you get to the point that you really do hate evil, then you won't do a very good job at staying away from it. And whenever you make friends with a lion, or you think you do, then you're going to be right there in the middle of that that's going on in the world. James chapter 1, verse 13 says God cannot be tempted with evil. And I've wondered about that. It says Christ was tempted in all points like we were. God cannot be tempted with evil. Now we have to somehow deal with that, don't we? But you know why I think God cannot be, and this is an opinion, why I think God can't be really tempted with evil? Because He can see what it does. You see, we look at it and we think that there is something good. We think of fun. We think of something that's pleasurable. He doesn't see that. He sees his son hanging on a cross because of sin. He sees the pain and the anguish that has been caused generation after generation after generation through drinking alcohol and our more recent times, or particularly recreational drugs. He sees the pain that's caused by immorality, and those things are not a temptation to him. If you really can see the finish, you remember the old line that said the finished product of the brewer's art, and it always had some beautiful picture of a country scene and a waterfall and whatever, and it was some whiskey commercial. Well, if you really want to see the product of the brewer's art, then you look at someone who's lying dead, an innocent child who's been killed in a car accident because some person was drunk. Or you look at a wife and children who don't know about their future or where their next meal is going to come from because the husband is an alcoholic or he's drunk. And that's more the finished product of the brewer's art. And you see so many lives that are wasted. And whenever we get to the point that we learn to hate evil, then we'll do a better job of staying away from it. And so we are to turn away from evil, and then thirdly, and do good. And that just means in everything that we do, that which is beneficial to others. The Lord's last three parables had to do with emphasizing doing good. The parable of the vine and the fruit-bearing branches in John 15, where he will say six times, remain in me, remain in me, remain in me, remain in me, six times. And if you remain in me, and then three times he'll say, obey my commands, then he said, you'll bear much fruit. Well, that's doing good. Remain in him. And whatever our hands find to do, give ourselves to that in doing good. And God will reward that from us. The parable of the wise and foolish virgins in Matthew 25. The parable of the talents in Matthew 25. The five talent, two talent, one talent man. It was about not their what they said, but about what they did or what they didn't do. And we'll be judged by our deeds. Paul stressed the importance of doing good in Galatians chapter 6. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially who? Those who belong to God's family or the family of believers, the New International Version says. And so there are many good things in this life that we can do. And you remember the story of the man whom Jesus told the parable about, the man who had the demons cast out of him, and he cleaned and swept his house, but he left it empty. And what happened? The demon went and got a bunch more, didn't he? And he came back and he found that place all cleaned up, and he was really happy. And so he came back in, and the man was far worse off at the latter end than he was the first end. You have to put good things. You can't just spend your life shunning evil. It doesn't work. You shun evil, and when you get an evil out, you have to replace it with the good, or the evil comes back in. And it comes back in with a vengeance. Have you not ever tried to break a bad habit? Every one of us have. And you have to find something good in its place, or that bad habit will come back and it'll put roots down deeper than it's ever had before, won't it? And then fourthly, the Christian, chapter 3, verse 11, seek peace and pursue it. Seek peace and pursue it. And you stop and put these things together and they make a really neat picture. We watch our tongue, we turn away from evil, we do good, and we seek peace. Now that doesn't seem to be the way, a very good defense in a world of wolves. But it is. Because you're depending on the shepherd anyway to protect you, aren't you? And here's what we're to be about in our life. I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but I know most of you have heard about the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys. And by the way, that's a real deal. It's not just folklore. It really is something that happened for generations. And in case you don't know this, then there's some good news about the Hatfields and McCoy. This is not a joke. There's some good news. After 125 years, The infamous feud between the Hatfields and McCoys is finally history. 60 descendants of the original clans gathered on Saturday, June the 14th, 2003, in Pikeville, Kentucky, and signed a document declaring an official end to more than a century of hatred and bloodshed. Most think the feuding between the McCoys of Kentucky and the Hatfields of West Virginia began in 1878 when Randolph McCoy accused one of the Hatfields of stealing a hog. The Hatfields won the hog war when a McCoy cousin sided with the opposing clan. Feelings festered. Other incidences occurred that finally resulted in the shooting death of Ellison Hatfield in 1882. Retaliation begat retaliation until the feud claimed 11 more family members over the next 10 years. Subsequent conflicts between the two clans have involved court battles over timber rights and cemetery plots. The treaty calling for peace reads, quote, "We do hereby formally declare an official end to all hostilities, implied, inferred, and real, between the families now and forevermore. We ask by God's grace and love that we will be forever remembered as those that bound together the hearts of two families to form a family of freedom in America." Rio Hatfield, who's the one who first thought up and came up with the idea of this ceremony, said, "We're not saying you don't have to fight, because sometimes you do have to fight, but you don't have to fight forever." And although the treaty was largely symbolic, both the governor of Kentucky and the governor of West Virginia were present for the nationally televised ceremony. Now, that's a pretty neat ending, isn't it? And I happen to know, and maybe some of you do too, I happen to know some of the descendants from those families. And the stories are pretty real. They kept them going in their families. But a Christian in this world of wolves seeks peace. He's a peacemaker, Matthew 5:9. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they'll be called the children of God." And you know, somewhat ironically, I think it's probably true that when you set your goal to be a peacemaker, there are going to be times when you get kicked. Because in order to be a peacemaker, you have to put yourself between two warring parties. And that's a pretty dangerous place to be. But it's where God wants you to be, because it's where the good is to be done. Boy, have you ever had a grudge going with somebody? And somebody on one side or the other finally came to their senses. And they came and apologized. And how it just dissolves the animosity. And all of a sudden you realize how foolish the whole thing was anyway. And you think about the feuding Hatfields and McCoys and all the hatred and anger and hostility and terrible things that were said and done between those families. And then it would have been a neat thing to be there, wouldn't it? To see those families resolve those differences. The Christian loves life because we have purpose in living and we have hope in dying. If we're really serious about living in the world of wolves the way that the Lord tells us to. But it's really a temptation to get out our sword, to grow fangs, and to get in there and mix it up with them. But you can't beat the devil. And the only defense that we have is our Master. And just wearing the name Christian is not enough to glorify God. He wants you to live as sons and daughters that are worthy to wear that name. And he's told us how to live. And you know, I keep coming back to this, I know, at the end of sermons, but we need help. We need to help one another live this way, don't we? Because it's really difficult to live this way in the world of wolves. And we need one another's encouragement, love, and support. And if you're not a Christian tonight, how do you say how much you need to be a Christian? Because you're fighting a battle that you cannot win without Jesus Christ. Satan is more powerful than all of the humans put together. And he will win. He'll let you think you're winning. But he will win. And you'll belong to him one day. But Jesus Christ has died so that we can come out of this world of wolves, and we can come out of it as His sons and His daughters and live with Him for all eternity in peace and security. We have a reason to live. We have directions to tell us how to live, and we have hope in dying. And so tonight, if you're not a Christian, or if as a Christian you've allowed yourself to wander away and get lost in this world of wolves, then the Lord calls you home while we stand and sing. Won't you come?
Do not let the word